The Wexner, Bella and Harry Wexner, Kol El Elyon and Smicha Anes program. It's my pleasure to welcome you all. Tonight's program has a historic dimension to it, in the sense that we will be dealing with something that is an issue, a very painful issue, that's been plaguing the Orthodox community for decades. It has always been the posture of Rabbonim and Talmidei Chachamim and Poskim throughout the generations to find a way of alleviating pain and suffering amongst our people. We are living in a time that is probably one of the most painful times, from a social perspective, one of the most painful times in Jewish history. Keep in mind that Baruch Hashem, there are no pogroms that we're concerned about here in America. There is no overt and aggressive anti-Semitism that threatens us in a physical sense. But there are more dysfunctional families, more distressed marriages, more young people who are leaving the fold. They are so-called the off-the-derech kids who are disenchanted and disaffected. And we have a tremendous amount of pain in our community. In the aftermath of much of this social pain is the problem of agunot. Broken marriages and divorce. Although statistically the Orthodox community has far fewer divorces than the general secular community at large, every divorce is filled with enormous pain. And of course, you know, Chazal speaks of the Mizbeach itself shedding tears. For decades now, we have been suffering and frustrated by a situation where the pain and the anguish of divorce has led to retribution and nekama, to the degree that we have thousands of agunot here in America, in Israel, and throughout the world. It is because of people, Rabbonim, who have dedicated themselves, people like Harav Mordechai Willig, who has been able to find a halachically supported and permissible way of preventing the tragedies that we see all around us, that we can be thankful and hopeful that a day will come when this will no longer be the subject of a conference or the subject of concern. Rav Willig doesn't need a special introduction any more than a caring father needs an introduction to his children. He is a Rosh Yeshiva here. He's the Rosh Kolel of the Bella and Harry Wexner Kolel Elyon. And he is our Rebbe. It is with great pleasure that I introduce to you, and of course it's a great kavod that I can introduce you, to Harav Hagon Mordechai Willig.
You can hear me without the microphone. It'll be better. No echo. Shus, Rabbi Chalap, Rabbi Blau, esteemed colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, The topic which we're discussing this evening is one which is of great importance to our community. And I'm very happy that I was given the opportunity to speak to you, particularly at this time. This year, in effect, is marking for me, believe it or not, a 10th anniversary of my involvement in this difficult parasha. It was in the year 1990 that a confluence of events, a particularly difficult case in my own community, on the one hand, and the fact that the yeshiva was learning Masechta Gittin last time, on the other hand, brought me to a realization that it's not enough just to wring one's hands in anguish and despair, but rather it's the tzav ha-sha'ah, it's the command of the hour to do something, whatever can be done, to help alleviate this difficult situation. And I say, as we have the Talmudic dictum, that kol ha-mekayem nefesh achas mi Yisrael, kilukiyem olam mole, when it saves one Jewish life, is the equivalent of saving an entire world. So too it can be said that an individual who has helped in the life of a Jewish person, not in danger of dying a physical death, but in danger of a lifetime of despair, this is also of tremendous consequence. And therefore, while I take issue with much of the introduction, especially the part about me, but I also take issue with a particular fact that Dr. Levitz mentioned, namely about the thousands of agunos. This is something which depends on how one defines the term aguna. What I mean, Dr. Levitz, is there may be thousands, perhaps, of Jewish couples who are languishing in all different stages of dead marriages, but the term aguna, which is, of course, you know, originally has reference to someone whose husband is lost at sea or at war, has been modernized to include unfortunate situations in which a woman is in effect entitled, according to the halacha, to a get, to a Jewish divorce, and does not receive one. There are many self-proclaimed agunos who are not necessarily entitled to a get al pi halacha, and although in many cases our hearts go out to them, one must be more careful in defining what's what, if only to reduce some of the hysteria which surrounds this difficult situation. So yes, there perhaps may be thousands of unfortunate couples who are arguing back and forth, jockeying for position, screaming, yelling, and kicking. And every one of them is categorized as an aguna, according to responsible definition. Dr. Levitz is absolutely correct in his assertion that Rabbanim, for as long as we can remember, have been attempting to help an aguna of any sort. We're familiar with the Talmudic statement, Mishum aguna kilu barabanan. Once again, we're learning Masechta Gittin. And we know how far Chazal are willing to go in relaxing certain standards of evidence. We know how far recent, relatively recent Rabbanim were willing and able to go. You know, we're here in Yeshiva Sabeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. The great rabbi told me the following story about our namesake, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, who passed away shortly, it's 102 years ago, I believe it is. Something a little over a century ago. 1897. Oh, 1897? You don't argue Rabbi Chalapa, especially on this matter. And I'm saying especially. And, you know, what are great men doing as their life is ebbing? You know, we read about sometimes in the literature, what What is Rav Yitzchak Elkanan doing in his last karchas in this world? What was he doing? He's about to pass away. He was not involved in sentimentality, in lengthy farewells. We just read Parshas Vayechi. We don't understand what people are doing at the end of their lives. This is great, great significance. The story is told that Rav Yitzchak Elkanan had written a tshuva about Aguna to permit a woman to remarry, which is such a chidush, which is so novel and so far-reaching, that he didn't have the... He hadn't signed it yet. Hadn't signed the letter to this rabbi permitting the woman to remarry. And he saw his hours were numbered. He said, bring me that letter, that tshuva. And he said, and he signed it literally with his last strength. He signed this letter to the Matir and Aguna, because he said, if I don't sign it, I don't know if anyone else will be able to permit her afterwards. This is how far our namesake, if you will, this goes, Elkanan went. You know, the later of Moshe Feinstein, how far he went in the aftermath of World War II to be Matir Agunus. In my travels about this prenuptial agreement, I occasioned to speak to a Rav from the Eda HaCharedis, from the Badatz of Yerushalayim, and he told me the following story. He said, in a lighter moment, he asked the great rabbi, Rabbi Yitzchak Yaakov Weiss, author of Minchas Yitzchak, who passed away a little over 10 years ago. He asked him, why were you privileged to be appointed as the Av Bezdin of Yerushalayim? There were many other great rabbis in your time. And that's a little bit of a chutzpah question for someone to ask, your younger colleague, a Talmud. Oh, although, you know, we find in the Gemara by Meher Achta Yama, people ask these kinds of questions. So he asked. So Dayan Weiss thought for a little bit. He says, maybe, I wouldn't say for sure, maybe, because after World War II, I did anything I possibly could to be Matir Agunus. This is famous, you read his Chuvis. In the aftermath in Hungary, after World War II, whatever. So therefore, great rabbis in the recent past, as well as our immortal figures of Talmudic times, have done whatever they could do to alleviate the situation of an aguna. I think it's important to understand that in all the attacks against Jewish law that have been recorded in recent years, how the Jewish law is inflexible and uncaring. I think it's critical that we understand that Jewish law is wonderful. And as has been written in a recent statement, which is being signed by many of the Rebbeim in our yeshiva, the pasuk says, "Drocheh darchei noam v'chol nesivoseh hashalom, kol nesivoseh." All of its ways include matters of divorce, and the system is wonderful. The only problem is that people aren't so wonderful. And yes, if there are problems with our inability to have people do the right thing, that is true. That is true because, unfortunately, given the realities of our situation, we don't have the full measure of authority which the Torah, in fact, describes. Especially here in the Golos, we just don't have it. So the system as such is a wonderful system, but given the limitations of time and place, we're not always able to enforce the system as it should be done. Therefore, in a normal circumstance, when there's a breakup of a marriage, like any other dispute in halacha, it should come to before a beis din. And, to start with this, the ideal is that every single city or region should have a beis din. A sitting beis din, a neutral beis din, a beis din which can judge fairly, competently, unimpeachable integrity, that's a reality which we unfortunately do not have. Don't have it. It's not because the system itself is poor. The system tells us, Shoftim v'shoftim titan lecha b'chol sh'arecha. And the Gemara tells us that it doesn't only mean in Eretz Yisrael, it even means in Chutz La'aretz. Perhaps it's a failure of human beings, and I include myself, I'm not coming to point fingers outward, perhaps it's a failure of human beings to do whatever they can to establish such what they did. Recently I've become involved in what's called the Bezdin of America, not for a lack of things to do, but simply, once again, we feel that a person has to do what he can to try to establish as much as possible a Bezdin which is known for its honesty, competence, and ability to solve problems. The Bezdin of America has shown in recent years since its reorganization a measure of success. But it certainly cannot be viewed in the larger community at the present time as the Bezdin. It's a Bezdin. In some of my headier moments, I confess, I've had conversations with Rabbonim in what I'll call our community, both geographically and more importantly, ideologically. And this is a broad range of individuals who are suffering when individuals from their communities, members of their shuls, were seeking refuge from what the rabbi thought was true justice and hiding behind various and sundry bote din from a different school of thought, some of which perfectly honest but just had a different cultural understanding, and some of which were not perfectly honest either. Rabbi Blau, I think, remembers some of our sessions in a case in which a very honest Bezdin from Rockland County was brought into a particular case, and the local rabbi who teaches here in the yeshiva, but there's a rabbi in what we'll call a modern community in Westchester, was under the gun. Who are these rabbis? Who are they? And we had to, in effect, appear before members of the board, if I recall correctly, to explain that these are honest people, and without bringing back all the details, one of our major opponents is another member of our faculty, who called Rabbi Blau and myself, another distinguished gentleman, forgive me for saying so, three blind mice. You know, Rabbi apparently does remember the incident. He has a very good memory. Yeah, well, there's a big problem. There's a big problem. You know, we don't have that. Now, is there something wrong with the system? The system is wonderful. There should be a sitting Bezdin. That's, everyone understands that they're the people who make the decisions, and that's all. But it just isn't that way. And although we had certain attempts were made, maybe the Bezdin in America will in fact lead to that. It's conceivable that it will lead to that. It can become, perhaps, potentially, a Bezdin of, we'll call it our community, of RCA rabbis or Orthodox Union shuls. Perhaps. Let's talk that kind of a possibility. I mean, my esteemed colleague, Rabbi Bleich, is a, I think, a bigger dreamer than I am. He spoke at in Cardozo at a conference I was in attendance about a national Bezdin, something which he printed later. And there should be a Bezdin which will cover the whole country, which I hope, I wish, but I'm a slower mover, I'm a more modest proposal. Let's get a Bezdin for our own community. And if we can arrange it, and I spent time with Gudolim and Eretz Yisrael speaking about this, what does it take to make a Bezdin, a sitting Bezdin with authority in a particular community? Must it be geographic? Do you need every single member of every shul to sign? Is it enough if the rabbi sign? I'm speaking, again, anecdotally of a case, nothing to do with divorce. I'm purely monetary matter. So a member from my Young Israel was sued by a member of a different Young Israel, but he wasn't sued to Beth of Young Israel rabbis, who would have understood, I think, better what what these balabatim, what their way of thinking is, and therefore what their agreement meant. But Hasidish rabbis were involved. And I'm assuming they're perfectly honest, but still the result was, I don't think, in sync with what was going on in the minds of the people whose mindset they were judging. Let me go back to the issue at hand. And the reason I'm saying this is very, very important. I'll tell you why. I don't like to speak about old stories. Many people here know them, some don't know them. Just yesterday, how's that? Yesterday, I had a discussion with the Manal of the Bezdin of America about the following situation. It relates directly to this prenuptial agreement which is before you. The prenuptial agreement, as it evolved, and it evolved with the input of many individuals on all different sides, there is an optional clause which says that if the parties agree, the particular Bezdin, be it Bezdin of America or any other Bezdin, is given the authority to adjudicate all matters, including monetary matters. But, of course, if it's an optional clause, it means it could be struck. Truth to tell, even if I wouldn't say it's optional, someone could still strike it. The only thing is a pen. It was inserted in that original agreement because it was thought at the time, it goes back 10 years almost, that lawyers won't allow women to sign this piece of paper because, who knows, the Bezdin will rule on the money and they can do better in court. Doesn't mean they're allowed to do better in court. But that was a feeling. So, okay, if this is what it takes to get people to sign, we'll put it as an option. Well, it took until yesterday for someone to realize what I've known all along, which is as follows. This is what happened. The real case. Couple signed a prenup, the same standard form you have in front of you, and nixed the idea of monetary jurisdiction to the best. Fine. So, they had signed it to the Bezdin of America about the prenuptial, about the get, you know? So they came to the Bezdin of America. So this husband gets himself a nice towing from Kings County. And next thing you know, there's a hazmana which the husband sends to the wife, summoning her to a Bezdin in Rockland County to appear for the adjudication of the monetary matters before them. This woman, I believe, has no intention to appear before that tribunal. She wishes to come to the Bezdin of America, but she struck that paragraph when they got married 2 years ago. So now, just follow through the logic, the Bezdin of America is ruling on the prenup, including this $100 a day obligation. But there it says that if the man comes to the Bezdin and says, I want to do what's right, and she doesn't. So then when that happens, the obligation is suspended. So if he is going to come and say, I want to go to a Bezdin, and she will say, well, I want to go to a different Bezdin, well, who knows of the Talmidim? What happens when people want to go to two different Batei Din? What's that? What happens? What's it called? Oh, almost a dirty word. You're right. Zabla, Zabor Lo'echad, which is ideally, again, in the ideal world, it's beautiful, it's perfect. Everyone can get the truth, and it's terrific, it's fantastic. In the real world, it's usually a disaster for a whole variety of reasons. So now, but if she will refuse to go, then we'll have to say to the man, you no longer have to pay her any money because she's not doing what the halacha requires. What are we going to do? Now, if he had suggested a corrupt Bezdin, we could then say, no, she's not doing what she's supposed to do. He suggested a corrupt Bezdin. He's suggesting a very honest Bezdin, a different mindset, an honest Bezdin. I'm just giving you some of the ins and the outs that the Bezdin has to deal with, back and forth of jurisdictions, and here and there, to and fro. It's complicated. And if you didn't understand every nuance, it's fine. Just giving you an idea of some of the complications involved in this difficult parasha. And again, if you have questions afterwards, I'm happy to answer them in detail. Just take notes. Some asked, there's no need for a prenuptial agreement of any sort. You have a ksuba. The ksuba tells us that the man has to support his wife as long as they are Jewishly married. That's all. That itself should be enough of an incentive to have him either, you know, support her, which the halacha requires, or give her a get, which is the only way out of his obligation to support her. The problem with this is twofold. Number one, in the absence of a binding arbitration to go to a particular Beis Din, it becomes very complex, and often a man can go to a Beis Din which is not to our liking. And this leads to number two, the man can then claim, and perhaps the Beis Din may even agree, that the woman is at fault. And if the woman is at fault, according to the halacha, the regular normal chiyuv ksuba does not apply. Also, the yeshiva know that there's a concept called a moredes, and there can be a back and forth. Is she a moredes? Is she not a moredes? It's his fault. It's his her fault. He says and she says. And all the while this is going on, he says, "Look, you know, I have a chazokah, I'm the muchzok, and I'm not going to give you a penny, and it's going to drag on for who knows, untold months or even years." That's why I believe it's important the binding arbitration clause be signed. And deep down, if you really want the support agreement to be valid under all circumstances, and the purpose of this agreement, that the Beis Din should be permitted to invoke this clause without having to have too much of an investigation. You know, but they didn't, no matter how sympathetic they are to a woman's cause, cannot run roughshod over the halacha. If the halacha says, Hamotzi mechaveh olav araya, and if he has a claim which is prima facie a claim, so until it's disproved, he doesn't have to pay. That's just the reality. No matter how much you may sympathize with her, if you go against the halacha, certainly if you go against the halacha knowingly, you run into a problem what we call a get me'usa, a forced get, which is it may not even be valid. So therefore, the obligation gives the Beis Din the in effect the teeth to move. But I'll tell you the honest truth. This prenup is divided into two parts, because there are people who may sign one or the other not one. That's exactly why it's divided into two. Frankly, to my mind, and again based on experience of almost 10 years of this prenup is in the street, the binding arbitration part of the agreement is more important. Because you can have a document of owing money, but if it's in the wrong hands to interpret the document, so it's not that valuable. If you have the binding arbitration, although the daily obligation is not there, but at least you have the ability to pull the parties together in Beis Din. If one of them doesn't show up, there could be a default agreement. But once again, the more power, if you will, the jurisdiction that the Beis Din has, the better it's able to function. As a further inducement, if you will, to have more women agree to sign this, I mean, this is meant for women's protection, you understand, but to have more women sign it, another clause was placed into the prenup which said that both parties agree that the Beis Din is authorized to decide the dispute, taking into account present laws, the laws of that particular moment, as they pertain to distribution of property in a particular jurisdiction, such as New York State, known today as equitable distribution. There are those who have problems with this from a variety of perspectives, and I'm not, in a sense, advocating it. However, I do believe it is permissible, halachically, for two people to empower a Beis Din to use a particular law in deciding their case. I'm saying it's in contrast to empowering a Beis Din to use the law of the land in general terms to decide their case. That could be problematic, because it may be what's called our cause in a certain way. But here, the people are not discussing the general laws of New York State. The laws of New York State change between the time that they sign the agreement and the time that they're breaking up. It's the original set of laws that applies. So it's just plugging in a particular law on the books at a particular time. They could have picked any law, French law, any law they wanted. And it seems to me that this is permissible. I have to tell you that although my work preceded the New York State Get Law of 1992, which is, again, not the topic for tonight. It seems to me that a signature of this prenuptial agreement is even more critical in the aftermath of that law. You're probably aware of the fact that much has been written that that law can lead to a serious problem of a forced get. The way around it, the way around that problem is by signing a document of arbitration to go to a Beis Din. Once you go to a Beis Din about monetary matters, you have no problem whatsoever with a get meusa. And we should not take this problem lightly. People just sort of gloss over it. It's a time bomb waiting to happen. I'd like to mention in brief that there have been other attempts at prenuptial agreements which preceded mine, and while each one has a certain advantage to it, there were problems in every one of them. Some of them were halachically perfect, but just unwieldy, just so complicated. No one knows. 5, 6, 7, 8 pages of contracts back and forth, and no one even looked at it. Frankly, I wish I could make mine shorter. We'll have to work it out somehow. Because every page that goes on, people lose patience. That's just the reality. There are those that actually involve halachic problems. Some, the problem of liquidated damages, an original RCA proposal, which fails to take into account the reality that in halacha, a person is not required to pay in Beis Din for, generally speaking, for psychological damage. So therefore, the idea that the husband is damaging the wife, quote-unquote, every day that she doesn't receive her get and is required to pay for it is just not halachically grounded. There are those that have very, very large support agreements. And the logic being, the larger the support agreement, the greater chance the husband will give the get, so he shouldn't have to follow through on this large support agreement. Problem with that is that some consider it to be what we call a knas, a penalty, a fine, which raises halachic problems. A person is not supposed to give a get under the threat of a fine, even if it's self-imposed, according to the Ramah. Some have applied this principle even to the prenuptial in front of you. The answer to that question is that it's not supposed to be an exaggerated sum. It's supposed to be a sum which is within the realm of normalcy. When I started, it was $100 a day. It was considered a nice sum. It was $36,000 a year. I haven't been keeping track of the CPI for the last decade. Someone can tell me afterwards how much has gone up in the last 10 years, and we'll try to make some kind of an adjustment, as people have done already. Then there are those who say that the support agreement should be absolutely unconditional, that the woman should be able to demand this money without any restrictions. What this means is, for those who, in effect, can't afford it, but have enough money to have to pay it, it's almost tantamount to what we call divorce on demand, because the person just would have great problems in doing anything else but. This is something which may be halachically valid if it's not what we call an asmachta, but no dayanim would ever agree to sign such a thing because they feel it's not equitable. You have to be fair to all parties. You know, a man is also a human being. So sometimes we should remember that. And sometimes he's right. I believe that the audience here, which consists primarily of young people, should be counseled in terms of this prenuptial agreement to do it, as was mentioned, I'm told, in some of the earlier sessions, far in advance of the wedding. And frankly, if I may be so bold, that it should be done by the chosn and the kal themselves. This is the subject of a dispute between my two rabbinical colleagues in Riverdale, once we had a session about this very point. This is, should the parents be involved, not be involved? I'll just tell you one story. There is a young man from my shul who got married a number of years ago, and to a woman from a fine family from a different community, and I knew both families. Well, three out of the four parents were lawyers. It was unbelievable. It was unbelievable. Back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. I don't know. They would come to me on their own. It would have been, fine. Nothing so tremendous was achieved by all this this loyalty movement. Now, obviously, there can be machlokas amongst lawyers, the same as there can be machlokas amongst rabbonim. And I'm not a lawyer, but everything I've done, I've consulted with lawyers. This is not to say that other lawyers don't argue with them. Other rabbis argue with me. That's just the way of the world. But what was done in consultation with attorneys as well as rabbonim. And as I've said many times, this document is, again, approaching the end of its first decade. It's still not canonized. It's not the Bible. And if the law changes, we have to make a major change. I was just told tonight, we have a Y2K problem. It says 19 on the document. I think that's a major problem. So maybe when we redo it, we'll have to make a few other changes just to satisfy some of the legal points, fine points that have been raised over the last 6 years or so since this was came into its present form. And I'm happy to make such changes. If there are halachic changes that could be incorporated to make it tighter and better, these are also, at least from my perspective, things that should be considered. I want to speak very briefly about some of the halachic opposition to this form. Again, very briefly. There are those who consider this a document to be what we call in Hebrew language an asmachta, which is a technical halachic term, conditional obligation, which is not binding. It seems to me, if you look carefully at the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, which are the two most important posts that we have to satisfy, you will find that it's not an asmachta for one of two reasons. According to the Ramah, if something is not exaggerated, it's not called asmachta. As in an over velo avid ashalim b'meitava, having himself above a metziah towards the end. According to the Mechaber, if a person accepts upon himself an obligation, what's called me'achshav b'bezin choshuv, that's just a code word taken from the Gemara, this overcomes the issue of asmachta. I concede that there are certain authorities who disagree with both the Mechaber and the Ramah, and according to them, it might be an asmachta. But, you know, we follow the Mechaber and the Ramah. Any time you deal with monetary matters, it's endless. There are other obligations which, in fact, invoke these respective positions. They are often relying on the Mechaber or the Ramah only. In our case, we're relying on the combination of them, so it's even better. There are those who claim that the obligation is halakhically problematic because the person won't know what he's signing. May be true, you won't know what he's signing, but I tell you how many hours I've spent people yelling at me about this, that, and the other thing. They know what they're signing. At least they think they know, because they're screaming. It's not something which is a form. It's a sign of blind. Now, as a matter of fact, people have told me, just put it into Aramaic, Rabbi. No one will object. Then they would understand, be a question. Even then, I think it would be binding based on the Dinah Shulchan Aruch. If you sign something, it's binding. You can't claim I didn't understand it. People are involved in a ksuba, that's binding. They say, who knows what the ksuba says? Those are the two major issues as far as that's concerned. Now, as far as the asmachta matter, I'd like to invoke and another matter. I think the main objection to this whole issue, this whole proposal, is what we call in Chassam Sofer lingo, Choresh Asim and Ator. All innovations are no good. To which my response is, not an innovation. For Hoyolo Olamim. This basic idea already goes back to an Achlat Shiva, which is 300 years old. It goes back to Takona Shum, which is almost 900 years old. You can look it up. It's there. In Achlat Shiva Simon Tess. There it's written that if the couple's no longer living together, that he will provide for her a gold coin every week or month. Until it's resolved. Till Bezin, you know, they write euphemistically, till Bezin will make Shalom Bayis. But that doesn't always happen. It means that the husband should be able to in effect, just run away. Now, in those days, when there was a total authority to the local Bezin, And still they were afraid of people slipping between the cracks and just ignoring the Beis Din. How much more so today, when there is no, as we said before, there's no Beis Din even in one community. People run to another community, and there's no responsibility. Unfortunately, even in a particular community, in one neighborhood, people run from shul to shul to avoid the wrath of the rabbi who is trying to help out the woman. I would like to give credit to my local colleagues in the Riverdale community. I told you we had an instance some years back, and the resolution was due in large measure to the fact that the rabbis maintained a common front, if you will, and couldn't run from one place to the other. So it's not really new, it's old. Now, of course, the old Takana Shum specifies a gold coin. No one knows what that gold coin is worth. You're not going to be able to collect with Takana Shum. By the way, Takana Shum is written in every classical Tanoim document. Rav Moshe Zal came along and said, it doesn't make sense to write a Tanoim, it's before the wedding. He put a new set of things which says almost nothing. Almost nothing. It's not so clear that it says nothing, because even Rav Moshe Tanoim says, V'yishnatu b'nechseyen shavah b'shavah, which according to some poskim means, believe it or not, equitable distribution. It's a machlokes, an ultra poskim. Does it mean something? Does it mean nothing? It's just a platitude. But in the original Tanoim, which is still around, still circulating, I was at a wedding just recently where it said, if Nachman's either a ktat yamel ketakana shum, that's us, that's his takana, but the rabbi had no idea, didn't know how to read it, and I was sitting there. And he said, Nachman, either of Tad Yamaket Akana, so he's just looking. He doesn't know what it means. Sheryl Meshiv. So my son happened to have been there, yelled out from the back, Shum. I said, okay, Shum. So he just went on. People just don't know what it says. They just don't know. There's even some Rabbanim who have educational positions. That's rabbinical positions. Rosh Hashiva is not the first time that this has happened in my experience. So it's there. The details aren't filled in. It doesn't say what a gold coin is. All the work is putting in the details. That's all it is. But more than that, I'm going to prove the point. Even if one is to maintain that this is a asmachta, my claim is that it can't be an asmachta because we have it in the Nachas Shiva, in the standard document. My very esteemed colleague, Rabbi Bleich, has counter-argued that Takana Shum work with the power of Hefker, Bez, and Hefker, which we don't have. Only they had it, we don't have it. One might respond to that in the following way. If you look carefully in the Svarim and in the bottom of the Evan Ezra, it says that there were two different areas of Europe, Ashkenaz and Poland. In one of them, Takana Shum worked automatically. That's obviously based upon Hefker, Bez, and the Rabbi Black is correct. But in the other area, Takana Shum only work if the parties agreed to sign to it. Clearly there's no Hefka Bez and Hefka. It's purely optional. If it's purely optional, then it means the Bez not telling me to do anything. I can either decide yes or no. So that seems to be to me a clear proof that they did not consider it to be asmachta. But here's my main point. If indeed people are just worried about halachic problems, let them just sign an arbitration agreement. That's certainly not against halacha. Rav Moshe Zal is a tshuva that is permissible. That's one of those tshuvas that was played with in three. There's three different versions of the tshuva. It's unbelievable. There's one which is in its original typescript. Believe it or not, you're not going to believe this. There's one version of the big Igros Moshe and one of the small Igros Moshe. I'm not kidding. You can look it up. It's in Evan Ezra, I think Chelek Dalet. People obviously use this very sensitive. But in any event, it's not a halachic issue, maybe it's a sociological issue, what's the best etza. The tshuva was written to a famous rabbi pair of Yeshiva Farakway, who, as far as I understand, to this day, will not perform a wedding, and he says many, will not they sign a piece of paper. If there's a problem, they'll go to a particular Beis Din, an honest Beis Din. And for good reason. He's spent so many hours with cases where they didn't sign it, and they're just going crazy. This Beis Din, this one's honest, this is not honest, so they're going to go to court. Just sign the piece of paper. No, just go to do an honest Beis Din. That's all. Why isn't that happening? The fact that even that's not happening is, to me, proves beyond any doubt that it's not the halachic intricacies that's really the problem. It's for the masses. It's simply inertia. inertia. Not people who don't, you know, who aren't willing to move often pay the price. I must tell you, and I'll end with this because I want to leave time for my distinguished colleague Dr. Schaefer and then time for questions. Again, speaking in a more positive light, the prenuptial agreement was signed by a couple, and sure enough, a woman receives a hasmana from, again, one of those Kings County Bote Din, demanding that she appear. And a toa in the whole story. The Bezdin of America faxed a copy of the agreement, which included even the whole thing, the monetary jurisdiction as well, to the toa and to the Bezdin that was Mazmin. I said, we're off the case. It worked. It worked to get other Bote Din off the case. You know, it works. Now, as far as court is concerned, I've been asked, what about in court? I don't like to speak in front of the Gedolei law, but what I will say about court is as follows. In court, as far as I know, there hasn't been a direct challenge to the legality. And there was an actual case where one party brought it into the court, another party said it's illegal for a whole variety of reasons. To my knowledge, it hasn't happened. And since it hasn't happened, de facto, it works. That's the nature of law. Unfortunately, in the case of the get law, it may cause a halachic problem. Some consider it unconstitutional, but it stands now, and people don't want to play with it. In the case of this, which I think would withstand a challenge if it ever came, it's a positive phenomenon. So it achieves a desired result. I will not talk as I can for hours about the halachic ins and outs of this, not for this forum, but I do thank you for your kind attention. Those of you who are not yet married, I hope that you will in fact sign this agreement when you do get married. There are, again, there is a consensus among many of the rabbeim in our yeshiva, not all, but many of the rabbeim, that this is a good idea, this agreement or others like it, it's a good idea. I hope that everyone who participates in this venture, which is really for the protection not only of ourselves, but of the entire community, because the more of us do it, the more widespread it becomes, even if the people in here, their marriages are 100%, but there are others, there's always the others, that would otherwise not sign it, but if you sign it, they will, that, we'll put it that way, their lives can be enhanced and their anguish can be spared if this becomes more popularized and widespread. So I thank you for coming, and I thank you for listening, and I hope that this initiative will be a mitzvah rabba of helping agunos, which will become more acceptable as the years go by. Thank you very much.
Shikoch, Rabbi Willig. I'd like to take note before I introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Schaefer. I'd like to take note of the presence of two rabbanim and their wives who have prominent pulpits here in the New York area. Rabbi Adam Mintz and his wife, they're from the Lincoln Square Synagogue. And Rabbi and Mrs. Yaakov Lerner from the Young Israel of Great Neck. I'm delighted to see you here. And personally, I wish there were many more rabbanim from our community who would be here. And knowing the two of you, I know that your work with couples and your work with premarital counseling is a model for other rabbanim as well. Our keynote speaker, who's been a very close personal colleague for many years. I have known him as a psychologist, and he is a clinical psychologist. He is also an attorney. He is the legal counsel for the New York State Psychological Association. Dr. Sylvan Schaefer is also noted for his work in divorce mediation. He is currently the clinical director and coordinator of training for the forensic psychiatry program at the North Shore University Hospital, Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Dr. Schaefer is assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Albert Einstein College of Medicine and teaches at Hofstra Law School. He is also affiliated with the Department of Psychiatry at Lenox Hill Hospital. His legal practice focuses on mental health issues of family law. He is very prominent both in the community of psychologists as well as in the community of attorneys. It is with great pleasure that I call upon Dr. Sylvan Schaefer.
Thank you very much, Dr. Levitz. Since we're speaking about courts, we learned that in the Sanhedrin, the junior members of the Sanhedrin always spoke first before the senior members, so that it wouldn't inhibit them from speaking. I understand intimately now the wisdom of the Sanhedrin setup, since I have to speak after a gadol such as Rabbi Willig, so that while it is inhibiting, I will try to speak on areas that weren't touched on upon by him so that I'm not contradicting him. He did mention, working backwards, about the three lawyer parents who were negotiating the contracts for their children, whether that was wise or not. And it occurred to me, having been involved in many of these, that they actually were very much involved, because remember, these days the children are signing away the parents' money. So they were really nogeya b'davar. So in some cases the children should sign, in some cases I understand why the parents are involved. Let me talk a little bit about the issues of both the prenuptial agreement and premarital counseling, which I like to look at as a package because I think they go hand in hand. And I will try to give you several different perspectives. In a way, I actually function in four different roles, and unfortunately in each of them I become involved in the divorce process. In one capacity as a psychologist, when I do treatment, I work with people who are either going through divorce, whether it's divorce mediation, divorce counseling, children who've gone through divorce. It's kind of the therapeutic side of that. In addition, as an attorney, I try cases that involve divorce matrimonial law, and I see it from the legal perspective. And I also, at North Shore, as the director of the forensic program, we are appointed by the courts to serve as their advisors on the custody determination. So as we do the assessment and we write the recommendations for the courts, and in some cases, by the way, we've been contacted by Batei Din in terms of what is in the best interest of the child. And a number of years back, I wrote an article in the Journal of Contemporary Halacha on the halachic aspects of child custody determination. And the interesting thing about my research was that halachically, the best interest of the child is a very prominent factor in custody determination. We predated the current legal system by several thousand years, while our system only became best interest of the child with the turn of the 20th century. It was in halacha that we saw best interest of the child going back much further. So that's another capacity in which I see some of the more litigious types of litigation. Once it gets to the court and they're referring it to us, we know that that's at the extreme level of litigation. And finally, in a fourth capacity, which is one actually that I would like to impart to the smicha students, because we talk about everyone else, but we don't always speak about your needs, because you're going to be out on the front lines someday. I'm often in a position of working with the professionals involved in divorce. And one of the things that isn't spoken about very much is we've discussed about the stress of the aguna. We're familiar with the stress of the children going through a divorce. We haven't talked about the difficulty of the rabbi, mental health professional, going through the divorce process. So what is the difficulty? As counsel for the State Psychological Association, I can tell you that nationwide, half of the malpractice and disciplinary actions brought against mental health professionals arise out of divorce cases, where they're caught in the middle. I can also tell you, in terms of clergy members that I've represented. They are sued. There's something called clergy malpractice, and one of the most frequent areas that you will hear about this is arising out of custody divorce litigation. In fact, one case which you're probably familiar with, which was in the New York Times, which I'm involved with, involved two very prominent rabbis, one a musmach of our yeshiva, who became involved in a question of confidentiality which arose out of a divorce case. And it's a very prominent case which will be setting precedent for the role of the rabbinate legally in terms of confidentiality and raises serious constitutional questions. But the source of that litigation is a divorce case. And what you can learn from that as you're practicing is Mishenitan Rishus Lamashchis Shuv Eino Mavdu Ben Tzadik V'Rasha. When custody and divorce litigation gets out of control, it consumes everybody in the process. And I've worked with Batei Din, where members of the Batei Din have been threatened, where they've been threatened with lawsuits, where they've been physically threatened. All in these types of cases. And you should know as you go into the rabbinate that this is something you should know about. And therefore, overall, everyone loses in this process. It consumes the people involved directly as well as the professionals working with them. And the best solution to this problem is not at the divorce end. It's not even with divorce mediation, which is better than litigation. But it's in what Rabbi Willig has been talking about this evening, and I think the fact that yeshiva is in the forefront of this process is the major step forward. It's prevention that we're talking about, avoiding the problem, not trying to repair it when we're in the divorce process. I'd like to discuss from two angles, two primary angles, the advisability of having a prenuptial agreement, one, psychologically, what this does for the couple and the family, as well as legally. What advantages it brings to the situation once a marriage is no longer salvageable. And in both cases, I would say at the outset, it is very advantageous and highly recommended. And whichever final arrangement we work out on the prenuptial agreement, however it turns out to be worded, it will be far better than not having a prenuptial agreement. Someone asked in our first meeting before we started the later topic whether or not the courts will accept a prenuptial agreement and an arbitration agreement to go before a Beis Din. The answer is, for the most part, yes. One of the cases that brought this to the forefront was many years ago, and my wife Marcy was involved in the trial. It was the Perlstein case in New York, which another yeshiva graduate was involved as well. Nat Lewin came in from Washington to try the case. It was a chassid who was still frum and his totally non-frum wife fighting over custody of a child. The New York courts, the New York Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, ruled that their prior agreement that the child would be raised halachically, meaning with kashrus and in a yeshiva environment, would be upheld by New York courts. That an agreement, a contract, even though it's religious in nature, which is the parallel of our contract this evening, is not a religious issue. It presents no constitutional issue. It is the equivalent of any other civil contract. So even though we are agreeing to go to a Beis Din, the Beis Din is no less valid than the American Arbitration Association. And as much as you can bind yourself to go to the AAA, you can bind yourself to go to a specific Beis Din. And as such, it is enforceable in New York law. Now, does that mean that every prenuptial agreement will be upheld? The answer is no. There are exceptions, but that is not because of the general principle of law, but because of the specifics of the agreement. And that's one of the things that I would like to address, is what goes into a good agreement, what is acceptable in an agreement, and what problems arise. And in drafting one, and in this case, the drafting and redrafting that is going on is very important because small wording changes do make a difference, can mean the difference between an agreement that works or not. When I was in law school at Columbia in contracts, the professor told us that when the clock strikes 13, you question not only the accuracy of the 13th strike, but of the 12 previous strikes as well. meaning that if you find a flaw in a process, you then begin to question the entire process. Therefore, we've got to be very careful in terms of what we put into the agreement, how we put it in, because something that is a flaw in one area could undermine the rest of the agreement, as well as Rabbi Willink has pointed out with one of the cases that he mentioned. Overall, there are certain qualities that an agreement can have, at least in New York State. Around the country, we have something called the Uniform Premarital Agreement, which at this point about 28 states have signed. New York is not yet a signatory, New Jersey is. But even the states that have not signed on have the general principles of the uniform agreement, but have minor modifications. For the most part, we can say that in every state, a prenuptial agreement in some form would be acceptable. They almost all agree that financial arrangements can be part of the prenuptial agreement. That can have to do with work, allocation of property, buying and selling property, decisions about alimony, or in our state it's called maintenance. Those are all things that can be part of the agreement. Two things are excluded almost uniformly from the agreements. That's child support finances and child custody determination. Again, that's not based on a halachic issue, but it's based on the assumption that no one can decide, not just that it's an arbitration group. The reason for that is not arbitration being invalid, but arbitration is based on the agreement of the parents to give over the right to someone else to make the decision. The court says, under our principle of best interest of the child, that these parents don't have the right to do that. It's the child's right, not the parent's right. So that they can't decide in advance, in 1999, what will be best for a child in the year 2010. And therefore, an agreement now about best interest of the child will not be upheld, because that's something that must be determined at that point. So generally, anything to do with child support and child custody will be excluded, because that's the right of the child and not the right of the parents. What makes a good agreement? Now that we know what can be in the agreement, what qualities are part of it? We've already talked briefly in our sub-meeting, and Rabbi Willick has mentioned the issue of distance between signing the agreement and the wedding. That is related to the issue of voluntariness. This contract, as any other contract, must be voluntary. If not, it's called an adhesion contract. If someone were to put a gun to your head and say you must buy this house, that's not a valid contract. There has to be an arm's length transaction in which each party voluntarily enters into the agreement. The feeling is that the closer you come to the event, the less freedom you have to make a decision. Obviously, if you're sitting and the chuppah is up, and you're at the tish, and she's sitting in the big chair with everyone around, it's very hard to say, I changed my mind. I don't like this clause. I'm not happy with the agreement. The feeling is you're not free to make that choice. One suspects once the invitations have gone out, that freedom may even disappear, because people are embarrassed. They don't want to change things. There's money at stake. There's no absolute number. But the longer you are away from the wedding date, the more freedom you have. That's one issue, is voluntariness. The other has to do with informed consent about what's at stake. Each party must be aware of that which they are signing away. So that if you're marrying Donald Trump and you've never heard about him, it must be someone deep in Nairobi who doesn't know Donald Trump, and she decides to marry him, and he doesn't tell her about Trump Tower and Trump Palace and all of the Trump Airlines, and she signs away a prenuptial agreement, that's not valid. Both parties need to know what they're giving up in this arrangement. Similarly, in the prenup that we're speaking about, they should be aware of what's involved with a get, what a bezdin is. There should be some information for each party to understand what the agreement is about. It doesn't mean that they have to know the difference between Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Willig's Pesach, but they need to know what this agreement is about. They don't need to know all of Shas to understand about a get me'usa. That's not what we mean by informed consent, only that they understand what this agreement is about. In general, in New York, there is a requirement for a prenuptial agreement to be valid that each party have an independent attorney. What they're concerned about is that the richer party will supply his attorney, who will say to the other one, don't worry, everything's fine, I read it, sign it. Again, this goes with the informed consent. The more there's informed consent in the process, the more likely the courts are to uphold that specific agreement. And therefore, the more the Rav who's giving this out says, this is what this is about, this is how it works, the more valid this will be later on. Therefore, I think the process of having the two witnesses and having kosher witnesses, the more people who are involved who can say what went on for later on, the better the agreement will be. There also has to be a sense that each person is not under pressure by the other party. And they look to see whether there's an unfair bargaining arrangement going on, which is different from the timing issue. They look to see how each person is treating the other. Again, that goes to the voluntariness of the process. If these things are in place, there's informed consent, voluntariness, and a full understanding of what is at stake, then for the most part, the courts will honor the agreement. Obviously, you read about Marla Maples and the first Mrs. Trump. There are many ways that people try to get out of the arrangement. Those are the exceptions. More likely than not, the agreements will be upheld. Do these agreements work, and what do they do to a marriage? For the most part, you won't see your friends going out to ask for these agreements. Number one, I think because it's not very common. People just don't do it very much. I think we don't have a culture in our community to do that yet. It would be very good. Equally important, most of you don't have very substantial assets involved. And you're not going to be thinking about that. You tend to see prenuptial agreements with people going in for their second and third marriages. Once they've been burned, they think twice about the second time, and they'll go for a prenuptial agreement. Also, if they have children from a prior marriage and they want to protect their assets, they will go for a prenuptial agreement. So past experience will help people see the validity of having the agreement. There's also a sense of stigma. How do you tell someone that you're about to marry that, look, let's think a little bit about our divorce? What do you mean about our divorce? We're in love, we're getting married, we're going to spend $50,000 on a wedding, and you're telling me about a divorce? What do you mean you want your lawyer to come and meet with me? We were thinking about going to pick out China and go get our marks and what color invitations. We would speak to lawyers at this point. It's simply not acceptable to them as part of this process, which means that the people who are most vulnerable and most in need of the process will probably be the last people to seek it out. In addition, and I think this is where an organized rabbinate can be very helpful, suppose one of the two, or even both of them, think that this is important. Which one of them is going to be the one to raise the issue? That means I'm the one who doesn't trust you. They may both be thinking about this, but which one of them wants to step forward and say you need this? And I mentioned in the smaller group, this is where we can learn from the Tochacha. Moshe said the Tochacha to everyone, whether they needed it or not. He didn't single people out. He said, everyone gets a tochacha. Similarly, if the rabbis said, we think everyone needs to have this, no one has to be embarrassed from their potential spouse that I don't trust you. It's Rabbi Willick's fault. I didn't want this agreement. I don't think we need it. I trust you, or my parents trust you. It's Rabbi Willick's fault. Speak to him about this problem. And we have Rabbi Mintz who requires it. Look, I want to be, it's a great shul. It's on the Upper West Side. We live here. It's Rabbi Mintz's fault. They will be most happy to take the blame for this process. It lets everyone off the hook. It's face-saving. And again, by the way, this is one of the things that the Catholic Church does. It's uniform. No one anywhere in any diocese can get married without having this. And that's, again, something that we can even learn from them. That there's no questioning, no one has to be embarrassed, everyone goes for premarital counseling. Let me say now, as we make a transition from the legal to the psychological, why I see a connection between premarital counseling and the prenuptial agreement. Both of them, first of all, are preventive. They are both things that should take place before marriage and all too rarely do take place. In addition, from my perspective, speaking as a psychologist who will also want people to get the prenup on the legal side, the premarital training is a good introduction to the couple to seek out and be receptive to the rabbi who says we need a prenuptial agreement. It's preparation for them to understand that they need to think a little bit past the romantic haze that they're in. That while this is a joyous occasion and we hope everything turns out fine, we do buy car insurance even though we take driving lessons. Part of this process is to train people that we hope you'll be fine, but look, this is the insurance. We'll help you learn about each other. We'll draw up the appropriate documents. Mezuzas nishdafen. It's there. It's in a corner. Hopefully you'll never have to open that drawer, but just in case it's there. The premarital training will alert them to the non-romantic part of the marriage, the nitty-gritty of marriage, which frankly, by the way, I tell couples that I'm working with, that is the marriage. The parts that you see on TV, the romance in the movies, that's very nice. But once you have finished with the chuppah and everything is signed and the shevah brachas are done, someone's got to do the laundry. Somebody's got to mow the lawn. Someone has to do carpool. That's a great part of marriage that you have to focus on. Who's going to be working? Which neighborhood are you going to be living in? Which shul will you daven at? What type of yeshiva will you send your children to? All of those are nitty-gritty decisions that are not dealt with when you're having a party with a caterer. Those are the real decisions in marriage. And a $100,000 wedding does not guarantee you more happiness or success in the marriage than someone who does it for shavah pruta. It's what you put into it. It's not the finances that you pay for the party. And unfortunately, that's what people concentrate on. I know from the premarital work that I do, they have huge piles of brides' magazines, but not that much time spent either on the prenup or on the premarital agreement. And that's what we're trying to get people to think about. I mentioned earlier that with the shortening of the courtship process, which includes the dating, which is down to Rabbi Mintz said that he meets with the couple three times. That may be more times than they've met on their own before they got engaged. We have a very short courtship, and we also, once the engagement has taken place for a variety of reasons, we have very short engagements. We've got to be in by June, and then we've got the 3 weeks, and then there's Yontif, and everybody goes away for Hanukkah, and the third week in January is no good. There are only certain dates. We've got 3 weeks that we can get married. Quickly, let's get going. So we have a shortened courtship, which means that the opportunity to learn about each other is shortened. Now, there are decisions that we make. If we want to buy a computer, months and months of research on buying a computer. It's going to be compatible for a while at least. Bill Gates will take care of that. But this is the most complex relationship we enter into. Two completely different people from different backgrounds, different parents, different styles, different personalities. And we're expecting them to mesh based on 5 dates and a 2-month engagement. What's going to be happening? We need to formalize within that process an opportunity for them to learn about each other, to find out about expectations, what they expect from each other in marriage. Are their values the same? Is their hashkafa the same? Are their personalities the same? All of those things you want to look at. And that's part of the premarital process that we hope that you as rabbis will become involved in. With the crowning point of that, once you've developed that rapport with them, I think you have a much better chance of having them sign the prenuptial arrangement. In other words, as a stranger who may have only a brief contact with them, it's harder for you to get them to sign something like this because it's not natural. It's not the thing that will occur to people first, as I better sign some papers and have my attorney review my wedding. That's not what's going to happen. But after you've worked with them, you've spoken to them, they've trusted you, you've raised issues, you've shown them that there's a future that they need to face, I think with that in mind, you have a much better opportunity for them to trust you to sign this piece of paper. Someone raised the question in the small group, and I said I would get to it a little bit more detailed now. What happens when the couple comes in with their own prenuptial agreement, a very detailed, complex arrangement of finances, stocks, bonds, pensions, all the things that go in, the really important things in life, and they say, well, how is this going to affect our agreement? Or we've spent all this time and money arranging a good prenuptial agreement. Will this document undermine what we've done? And that's a serious concern. And I can also tell you that attorneys are extremely territorial. If they've worked out an agreement, they don't want the interference of a third party. Not that it's a religious agreement. It's someone who's telling them we've got to change things. What I tell people in that situation is this agreement will be the final clause that will make the larger one work. If someone is being blackmailed with a get, all the pages of your agreement become worthless because you can't control that. Despite the get law in New York, which has been gotten around hundreds of times already, we see people just never file for the divorce. If they don't want to get a divorce, which many people don't, they don't have to give the get. So I explained to the attorneys, unless you follow through with the halachic aspect of the piece of paper, everything you've written in the other agreement may be undermined. At that point, they will see a value to integrating this process into the civil premarital process. And you've gained an ally rather than an adversary. I've gotten a note that we're running out of time. Let me just sum up by saying that we have here tonight and in this process a rare opportunity to change the course of people's lives. We sometimes wonder where we take turns. We come to various crossroads. We don't know which way to turn. The point that people are when they get married is one of the most significant choices they make in their entire lives. The premarital counseling process and the prenuptial agreement are our opportunity to ensure not just that marriage, but future generations as well. The damage done in a custody divorce litigation is not only to the couple, but to their children and succeeding generations. If you look at the research by Wallerstein, you see, and it's been done longitudinally over two decades, children of divorce, their ability to bond and have good marriages is severely affected by the divorce of their parents, which means it's not just one generation, but generations down that we're having an effect. These people not only are harmed, but it affects them in terms of their Yiddishkeit as well. The research that we've seen is that in divorcing families, we see people also leaving religion in a higher proportion. So we not only have a social, legal, economic, halachic issue, but we have a halachic social issue. The future of the generations that we send down can be linked to the work that we do with the couples before they start their marriage. And that's a very heavy responsibility for us, but a wonderful opportunity. And this is our chance to make a very big difference at a very, very small cost. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Schaefer. For those of you that are in the Wexner program and in the Smicha program, you will be privileged to have the opportunity of taking a course with Dr. Schaefer this coming semester. He will be teaching in Yitz Hashem a course in mediating family conflicts, and there's certainly a lot to learn from him.
If my wife likes me.
Okay.
We'll mediate that.
Are there any questions either for Rabbi Willig or Dr. Schaefer? And if there are, I'll ask Josh if you can go around with the microphone so that we can hear you. Okay. Yes.
I appreciate that you mentioned that parents actually would get involved in financial questions and financial matters. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
when parents get involved, it's for a number of reasons. Frequently, it's at the insistence of their children, meaning that given some of the educational and social needs of young marrieds, their parents may be supporting them. They may be purchasing a house, they may be purchasing objects for them, they may make an agreement. And by the way, we've had agreements between in-laws on support issues. In other words, the two sets of parents may be agreeing that somebody's going to be learning for several years, that they may be supporting them. They are, in a sense, making a contract of support. That's not the same as the prenuptial agreement for the couple, and certainly not the halachic agreement, but it's another type of agreement that's increasingly happening, that the parents will be supporting the couple and therefore have signed written agreements for support for X number of years. But that's not their prenup, that's the parents' prenuptial agreement. That's binding for them contractually as well. Usually not. Certainly they shouldn't be involved in the halachic part. That's between the members of the couple.
Abby?
I think everyone was a concern. I've been teaching the seniors at Yeshiva University High School for many, many years, and I don't let them leave my grip until they understand that they have to sign a prenuptial contract when they get married. Early on, many years ago, I had spoken to Senator Begay of MTA, and I wondered whether they would be willing to teach this to the young men. And there was resistance. Just last Saturday night, I met with a young Kala, former student of mine, a member of my community. She's engaged to a brilliant young man who was at his yeshiva for a short, about a year or two, and then transferred to another university. He's also a very learned young man. And she brought up the prenuptial contract. You know what he said to her? What's that? Isn't that like what Ruby Zora's done? It's just a comment, but I don't think that until the rabbinians certainly here make it understood to the young men, and I don't understand that the young men, because all they understand the development of young women, so I don't know at what point it's, you know, a good idea to do this, but I don't think that this is a consciousness about young men.
My question relates to what Abby just said. Have I will refer to some kind of the document that seems to be emerging from, I think it was Rose, you said something about the rabbinic sign or something. Could you elaborate on what that might be?
I think that both questions or comments have to be responded to. I'm disappointed that this young man who you're describing as being so brilliant was totally unaware of this agreement. I could say that I think that anyone who set foot in my shir is not unaware that this agreement exists. It's not to say that everyone who set foot in my shir signed it. I think everyone who set foot in my shir knows that it exists. I think so. I must tell you that I will voice my concern. My concern is, and I've been dealing with the development of young men over many years, that the yeshiva does not prepare them adequately for marriage. This has nothing to do with prenuptial agreements, has nothing to do with anything of the sort, just to prepare them what to look for in marriage, what to look for in finding a proper marriage partner, how to treat a wife. They're simply not prepared. Frankly, when I had the privilege of teaching younger students, approximately the age of your seniors, for quite a number of years, I would speak to them, because I knew I lost my grip very early on, and they were going on their way to other rabbis in Israel and everywhere else about what they should be looking for and how they should be approaching this very critical, as I say, the most important decision of a person's life, is who to marry. And that would be, in effect, a one-session discussion. And they began to teach older students, and as unfortunately, the divorce rate is increasing so drastically, I began devoting an entire series of shiurim, we try on a weekly basis to discuss what to look for in a marriage, how to be involved in a marriage, how to treat a wife, which, you know, I don't discover America. I quote from a great Rabbonim who have written on this topic. And in that context, I make sure to speak about things of this nature. And it becomes a whole unit that the boys in my shiur are used to, and some have heard it four times, five times. They just keep it every year, but we try with a different spin. I shouldn't be bored, but every year, reinforcement. And I would love to share this concern with my colleagues and say, hey, you know, speak about it. I must add that I do meet with any couple that I'm involved with as a Masada Kedushin, I meet with in advance. That's a prerequisite. And at the time, I give again, aside from discussing the specifics of how the wedding ceremony will take place, I speak about the prenuptial, I speak about marriage. And often the boys, the Talmud of mine, has heard this before, but his wife never heard me say it. And there are times when it comes up. Of course, I can't reveal even approximate identities, but couples come to me who were in my shiur, let's leave it, in the 70s, okay? In the 70s, so now that means you're talking over 20 years ago, and fortunately, and I count this among one of my biggest accomplishments ever, couples that were teetering on the brink of breaking up, and sometimes by myself, and sometimes with the help of psychologists and marriage counselors and all different kinds of ways, many have been saved. If you save one, as I said before, not only you save one with being an aguna, a much better way is to repair the marriage. Not always easy. But you have a connection. That's my real concern. As far as your concerns, both of you, very, very important and well spoken, this agreement needs more publicity, correct? It needs more publicity even within the yeshiva before we go out of the yeshiva. And that's where this document that has been drafted is addressed. It is a document which basically advocates that couples sign a legally and halachically proper prenuptial agreement. It doesn't specify which one. It calls upon Talmidim in the yeshiva to sign and Rabbanim in the field to support its signature. This call has already gained the signatures of a number of members of our rabbinical faculty here at the yeshiva. It is not in its final form, signature-wise. We still have a number of other rabbeim who, some are in Israel now, and some just haven't gotten around to signing it. I do not expect unanimity, so no one should be disappointed down the road that every rabbi doesn't sign it. There are a number that I believe will not sign for a variety of reasons. But I do think that if a significant number of the rabbeim will in fact sign this piece of paper, it will give an extra added boost that there are quite a few of the rabbeim in the yeshiva who support this document and urge that Talmidim sign it and the Rabbanim in the field advocate it. I don't think it's appropriate that the document be circulated now because there are still signatures we hope to add to it, but amidst Hashem, I understand, my brother, you share this understanding with me, that once we get as many signatures as we can, that it'll be made public. It's not meant to stay in a drawer. That's the prenuptial stays in a drawer, so it is darfin. But this is meant to go out in whatever is considered an appropriate forum, which has to be decided, with the signatures that are on it. Now, I know that they're going to be an immediate problem. Why didn't he sign it? And he signed it. That's perhaps why we didn't do it until now. But at this point, perhaps for reasons such as that you brought up, we feel that it's important that such a thing be signed. Hope that answers the question. Yes.
I would also like to comment with regard to your concerns, which are, of course, our concerns as well. But we wouldn't even have had this forum tonight. I just came from a conference, the Nefesh Conference, of Orthodox mental health professionals, Rabbonim and Mechanchim, and heard some things that made me take notice that are very relevant here. Here in America, we are very much behind other countries in terms of premarital counseling. Israel for sure is behind. Countries like Brazil, the Orthodox community in Brazil requires 20 sessions of premarital counseling prior to getting married to any Orthodox. 2 hours each session, 40 hours of premarital counseling, and take my word for it, it is not overdone. In England, in South Africa, premarital counseling is a prerequisite. And premarital counseling, as you heard from Dr. Schaefer, ought to go hand in hand with the prenuptial agreement. It is part of a total package. And my hope is that with the spreading of the word, with the change process, and this is a process, not just a process of educating people, it's even a process of developing the form. You heard from Rabbi Willig that the form itself is in process. My hope is that in the future, we will not need conferences like this. It will be changed. Yes?
I'd like to ask Willig whether there is any serious problem. Was consularis the result of the prenuptial agreement that would be against Muslims?
Does anyone consider a get given after the signature of this prenuptial agreement to be a get mu'use? Okay. A get mu'use, which means a forced get, is a get which is given under duress, either physical duress in its most blatant form, or what we'll call financial duress. Now, the critical word is duress. Every time a man is married to a woman, the Torah imposes upon him an obligation to support his wife. Now, if he divorces her because he can't afford to continue supporting her, that is not a get mu'usa. Every single get then would be mu'usa because there's an obligation of support. The only way to argue that this get would be mu'usa would be to declare that the agreement is one of two things. Either it's a penalty agreement. If it's a penalty agreement, then it's arguable that even a self-imposed penalty might constitute get mu'usa. The Ramah seems to say that although ideally a get should not be given when there is a self-imposed penalty, but post facto b'di'evet, the get would be valid. And there are those who disagree on both sides. Some say it's okay even l'chatchila, and there are some who say it's no good even b'di'evet. So if it's considered to be a penalty, there is a problem. That's why my view is we cannot write in an exaggerated sum, because I don't want to get involved in this dispute in what I consider to be perhaps a penalty, and someone else does not view it as a penalty. If it's not an exaggerated sum, it cannot be viewed as a penalty. That takes care of the penalty problem. There's an additional problem, which was raised before, called asmachta. Asmachta, according to some, is an obligation which has no halachic standing, it's not binding, it's not valid, according to certain authorities, even if it is not a penalty. As long as it's a conditional obligation. If this happens, then I'm obligated. There are certain authorities who maintain that even if it's not an exaggeration, as long as it's conditional, it would be an invalid obligation. If it's an invalid obligation and a husband gives a get because he doesn't want to pay an invalid obligation, they could raise an issue of get mu'usa. My response to that was, I'm repeating it again, that it's not an invalid obligation, not according to the Shulchan Aruch or Yosef Karo, because the expression of Me'ach Shev Bebezin Choshev is found, and not according to the Ramah, again, because it's not an exaggeration. That is my response. Could a serious posek disagree? Certainly. Does anyone state in a post-facto situation, after the fact, that a get given with the involvement of this prenuptial agreement is in fact null and void, and the second marriage is an invalid marriage with all the terrible results of that? I haven't heard that. By contrast, it has clearly been written and printed by more than one person that in the absence of a prenuptial agreement, if you divorced in New York State after 1992, that the get is invalid. So if you're worried about invalid getting, it should at least lead you at least to sign the arbitration agreement to go to a Besdin, because there are printed opinions of very serious poskim, that is a cloud of ma'usa hanging over the get. So I think that should, if you're such a big tzaddik and afraid of get ma'usa, at least sign the arbitration agreement, which is to the contrary preventing a get ma'usa chashash. And if you don't want to sign the obligation for religious reasons, can't change the objector, I can understand your perspective even if I don't agree with it. So therefore, I'm explaining to you that the logical outgrowth of that statement is that every couple in New York State, especially, should sign at least an arbitration agreement to a Beis Din to avoid what's been printed already. That, as a member of our faculty has written, every get since July of 1992 is under a cloud, or maybe a very thick cloud, a heavy cloud, of get ma'usa. That's not a lone opinion. Yes.
In a case where a couple who is not in court of this opportunity, is there anything that they can do once their marriage is taking place?
In Riverdale, we had what we called a postnuptial agreement. I'm not an expert in the legalities of the agreement. I have to confess that my wife and I signed one, which is lying in a drawer somewhere. I think that the lawyers we consulted said it was valid. I've heard others say it's not. You know, it's like Rabbanim, you know, it's the differences of opinion. Certainly, the signature of such an agreement, irrespective of its validity if challenged in a secular court, I believe it's valid according to the halacha, and I believe it serves a great, in great measure, to encourage our young couples getting married to sign it. They don't say, "Hey, Dad, you didn't sign it. Mom, you didn't sign it. What do you want from me?" I say, "Well, I got married. No one ever heard of this." I say, "But so sign it now." So if you sign it now, for that reason alone, I believe it's something which should be done. Aside from Riverdale, I'm not aware presently of other communities where it was done. I think there was talk of doing it in Teaneck. Don't know if it ever happened. I don't remember. But if someone wants to have such a session, I'm happy to come and speak about it.
I would just like to add that from a civil standpoint, there is such a thing as a post-nuptial agreement, a marital agreement, on a civil level, and even if someone hasn't signed before the marriage, there is no bar to them to sign afterwards. Essentially, in New York, that's what a separation agreement is. Most people do when they're ready to separate. Remember, they're still going to be not divorced for a year, at least. So you certainly could sign it, and probably, at least from the civil standpoint, you could sign this type of an agreement afterwards as well. The halachic issues might be different, but civilly you could.
I want to thank Rabbi Willig, Dr. Sylvan Schaefer, and all of you for coming and being part of this evening. And I hope a day will come soon that our awareness of this will be so great and the implementation will be so widespread that the issues of today will no longer be the pain and the travails of tomorrow. Thank you very much and good night. Thank you.